Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Back together, our little club, Evening Under Lamplight, meeting fortnightly here at Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, inviting you to attend as we come this week to Canto 5 of Dante's Inferno and venture into the second circle of hell, where we find the peccator carnali, that is to say, the carnal sinners, the lustful. We're coming now to the first great section of Dante's Hell, the suburbs, we might say, dedicated to the sins of incontinence, the area for those who didn't deliberately choose to do evil, but just failed to choose to do the right thing. The people who fell short through self-indulgence, weakness of will, and easy yielding to appetite. These are states of the soul in which we are not actively antagonistic towards others, but just too self-centered. And remember that for Dante, the great aim of life is to promote the community spirit in which we all live and share together. Violence and fraud are on the lower levels of hell, and they're obviously disruptive to this community. But here, to a lesser extent, self-indulgence can be ruinous too. We'll see this as we attend further. So, this evening, under lamplight, we're attending to lust. Always a popular subject. But we'll find, I think, that Dante has a somewhat different conception of lust from the picture our culture shows to us. Our culture regards lust as one of those naughty impulses we believe we're not supposed to feel, but we are fascinated by it and secretly applaud it and desire it. We brag or joke about the lust we feel. If I feel great lust for someone, well, doesn't it show what a really strong sexual person I am? Men lusting after women can come across as creeps, and rightly so, since to them in their heat, the woman is just an object to satisfy their desire. If women express their lusts, though, isn't that often seen as a great breakthrough, liberating themselves from the old constraints that denied women the expression of their sexuality? Lustful men are often turned on by the idea of a lustful woman. Living in this fantasy world, he believes she has the hots for him, and he doesn't mind being treated as an object as long as he is treated. But doesn't it often happen that if that lustful woman gets too close, the poor man, only lustful in his fantasy world, often panics and retreats, satisfying no one? It's all a big mess, it seems. But it needn't be. Lust, the condition of feeling strong sexual urges, but without anything more than physical desire, well, this kind of lust can be something beautiful in two people, straight or gay, who are actually sharing their lust and are open to the pleasure they can give each other. The appropriate song to play at this point, surely, is Jane Birkin and Serge Gainsbourg's 1967 scandalous single, Je t'aime, moi non plus. The track, however, is nearly 4.5 minutes of heavy breathing and tender words. That's a long time to listen to this, but, well, it certainly will set the tone for our show about Dante's Lustful. So, let's do it. Je t'aime, moi non plus. Let's stop there. Let's stop there. I mean, voyeurism gets boring for the ones outside of this. I'm not saying they're getting bored, but we can only listen to so much. Let's stop this now and move on to Dante. See, the song's called Je t'aime, moi non plus. We know what je t'aime means. I love you. But what about the second half of the title, moi non plus? Literally, it means, I don't love you anymore. But what it really means is, me neither. I love you, she says. Me neither, he replies. And what does that mean? In the depths of her sexual passion, she whispers, I love you. And what can he reply? Maybe with a man's tendency to hold back his emotions. Maybe he's trying to avoid being gushy and saying, I love you too. So he kind of makes a joke and gives the nonsense reply, me neither. Or here's another possibility. Maybe he recognizes that her je t'aime is uttered in the heat of passion and simply means she's getting off on the pleasure he's giving her. In other words, je t'aime in the context means something like, keep doing this, you're turning me on. Something like that, or anything but I actually do love you. So he says, yeah, I don't really love you either, but yes, let's keep doing this. Now let's attend to the rest of the lyrics, too. Here they are, loosely translated into English. He says, like an unresolved or never-ending wave, mounting and unfurling without end, I come, and I go back and forth like the waves between your thighs, and I hold myself back. And she says, You are the wave. I am the naked island on whose shoreline those waves keep coming back and forth. And I join myself up to you. And he says, physical love is without issue. Which can mean it never ends, or it could mean that mere physical love produces nothing, is without fruitfulness. It's sterile, and so I suppose they must live in the moment, which is what Jane Birkin and Serge Gainsbourg certainly seem to be doing. The Pope at the time, no surprise, condemned the song. But why? Presumably because the song was so explicitly sexual, as though mere sexuality in itself was some kind of sin. 50 years ago, the official doctrine was that sex existed only for procreation, the issue that the song says physical love does not produce. Well, here's another mess. But let's go back now to the medieval definition of lust which Dante is drawing upon. As opposed to the modern sense of lust as strong physical desire, St. Thomas Aquinas defines it as seeking venereal pleasure not in accordance with right reason. Notice, first of all, that according to this definition, lust is not some feeling or desire, but an action, seeking venereal pleasure in a certain way. But what, we may ask, is venereal pleasure? Does kissing count? Does anything short of penetrative sex count? We'll let the celibate men argue this out, as they have done. How far can they go? More important for us here is that not in accordance with right reason. In other words, sex that the healthy intelligence does not approve of. This would refer, for instance, to sex between parents and child, or between siblings or other near relations, or sex with someone unable to consent to sex, like a child, or someone almost passing out from too much alcohol. By this definition, je t'aime, moi non plus, may not be describing the sin of lust at all. If these two people are fully aware, consenting adults, giving pleasure to each other, which seems to be the case, then I'm not sure how right reason could object, unless it objects that they're not married. But we simply do not know that, and must suspend judgment, right? But some of Serge Gainsbourg's other songs, however, are quite clearly not in accordance with right reason. I'm thinking of two songs in particular. There was the song called in English Lemon Incest. Gainsbourg enjoyed playing with words, and the French title becomes a pun. Un zeste de citron, meaning the zest or tasty rind of lemon, sounds similar to un zeste de citron, or lemon incest. Sort of funny, until we realize that he sang the song with his daughter, Charlotte Gainsbourg, and produced a video showing them both lying on top of a large bed, he with no shirt, she in shirt and panties, adopting various sensuous positions with each other. Perhaps in the mid-80s one could get away with it, but no one today would deny that it violates right reason, and thus fits Aquinas' definition of the sin of lust. Another song Gainsbourg seemed to find cute or provocative was Les Sucettes, or Lollipops, which describes a woman singer's delight in licking lollipops. Nothing wrong there, but the song quickly makes it pretty obvious that it's not lollipops she enjoys licking. A metaphorical game that the singer, teenage France Gall, apparently did not pick up on. If the man gets his enjoyment from watching an innocent girl sing unawares a song about oral sex, then is this seeking venereal pleasure not in accordance with right reason? I don't think we'll sample these two songs this evening under lamplight. We have other things to move on to. But thanks to Leslie Graham, who pointed out these two other songs to me. Now, there are other kinds of sexual intimacy that right reason would condemn. Think, for instance, of sexual relations that betray the trust someone has put on us, such as breaking a spouse's trust through committing adultery, and especially having sex with your partner's best friend. And that leads us over to another song, There are so many songs about sex that Right Reason does not approve of, especially, of course, in the country music catalog. How about Long Black Veil, a ballad that shows how far the modern culture has diverged from Aquinas? Here's the song of a man who is hanged for murder because he cannot produce in court his legitimate alibi. He had been in the arms of his best friend's wife. The story does not condemn the adultery. The romantic heroism of the strength of their love overrides the betrayal of trust. First recorded by Lefty Frizzell, the song has many versions, but for musical extravagance, I think none beats the band's version, with Rick Danko taking the lead. The Band with Long Black Veil, a culture clash between country music and Thomas Aquinas. Long Black Veil, like many poems and songs since the Romantic era, seems to praise all kinds of passion, as though passion in itself justified everything. On the other hand, it seems that many religious leaders condemn passion of any kind, as though strong feelings themselves are sinful. Dante comes somewhere in the middle. He never condemns passion, only passion wrongly directed. That's why we need il ben dell'intelletto, the good of the intellect, so we can discern which is the right direction for our passion and which is the wrong. But now, before we move on to the lustful in the Inferno, there's a little episode at the beginning of the canto we should attend to. Dante and Virgil have left Limbo and now descend to the second circle, which forms a circle smaller than the previous circle, because the pit of hell, as we discussed last time, is a kind of funnel getting narrower as we move further down it. And the first thing Dante sees here is Minos horribilmente, Minos the horrible, sitting there with an awful grin on his face. He's the judge, and another of the functionaries of hell we meet in our descent into hell. In Virgil's Aeneid, Minos, once a wise king of Crete, is the chief magistrate of the underworld, judging the lives of the dead souls that pass before him. Dante picks up this image, but with some important changes. Like the other infernal functionaries, Minos is a monster. Human, mostly, apparently, but he has a tail. In fact, this tail is his main feature. Every dead soul comes up to Minos and confesses his or her sins. Then Minos wraps his tail around his body, and the number of times the tail is wrapped around the body indicates the number of the circle to which the soul must descend. There's something grotesque about this elaborate way of pronouncing judgment. But wrapping his tail around himself can also symbolize the self-love, even the auto-eroticism that characterizes this part of hell. More significantly, I think there's something mechanical about this, too. Just as we saw that Charon the ferryman acted mechanically, so too does Minos. He grins, and his tail springs into action. It's almost a cartoon effect. The souls waiting in their long queue also seem mechanical. There's certainly no time wasted. The souls come up to Minos, speak their confession, hear, or rather see, the judgment, and immediately are thrown down into the pit to the spot designated for them. Dicono e odono, e poi son giù volte. Dante stands watching all this, and then begins to move on, but Minos spots him and sends him a taunt. Look out how you enter this place, and watch out whom you trust, he calls out. Don't be fooled by the wide door into hell. In other words, he puts the fear into Dante about whether he'll ever get out of this place. Minos is, in essence, tempting him to abandon his trust in Virgil. But Virgil springs to his aid and repeats the sacred sentence that Dante is here on a divine mission. This is the token phrase that dismisses any opposition to their progress down here. But this is also a warning to Dante and to us, the readers, not to trust those people speaking to us in hell. In a few minutes, Dante will encounter Francesca, who tries to stir his pity for her. But pity, as we'll see, is the wrong response to her sweet words. Dante nevertheless does trust her account and is overwhelmed. We'll see more in a few minutes. So, Dante and Virgil move on, and as they move on, Dante can hear more and more loudly the cries of misery as sounds on sounds of weeping pound at me. They've come to the place of Ogni Luce Muto, where all light is mute. Mute? How can light be mute? Perhaps we could say that light is a symbol of intelligence. There's some kind of intelligence here. The souls can, after all, speak with Dante, but that intelligence is inoperative. Francesca has the intelligence to speak to Dante, but that intelligence is mute. Her speech, as we'll see in a few minutes, has no intelligence in it. Can we connect this to anything in our everyday world? Do we ever find ourselves in a place where all light is mute? Oh, yes, well, why am I asking such an obvious question? Aren't we now living through a political drama where all light seems mute? And not just the politicians, some much more so than others, but also the media, chattering about policies and election results and not making a lot of sense. We then might want to ask, what is there about this sort of thing that connects with Dante's idea of lust? In what way, besides, of course, the obvious one, does Donald Trump, for instance, illustrate the sin of lust as Dante presents it? Or someone who, believe me, this is true, someone who this morning on Facebook announced that he was on the side of truth and freedom and praised the Brexit vote for freeing the country from the, quote, old Jews who control the money. Certainly whatever light is here has remained mute, and that guy surrendered control to the nasty catchwords he'd picked up from some infernal wind. We'll see more about this infernal wind in a minute. Well, it seems an odd thing to say, but the main feature of these lustful souls is their passivity. Lust, according to Dante, is not lusty, but almost anemic. As usual, we can understand this more clearly by attending to the setting in which Dante places these souls. The circle of the lustful is a place of no peacefulness. The lustful souls are continuously swept along by a bufera infernal. I love that word. The bufera infernal, a hellish wind or storm. They have no movement of their own, no control over themselves, and all they seem able to do is shriek, weep, and lament. Le strida, il compianto, il lamento. And they curse God as they are tossed all over the place. Di qua, di là, di giù, di su, limena. And like the others we've seen before them, they have no hope. No hope of any rest or of any lessening of the pain. I don't suppose many of us have ever been swept along by a squall like that. But perhaps we've been in a crowd that pushes us along till we're breathless and panicked by having no control over what's happening to us. Picture this as a never-ending state of affairs. Oh, yes. And they are also being impelled round and round that circle of hell, so that they're not even getting anywhere, but just going over and over the same territory. And now, picture this as the image of lust. What do we learn about lust now and the psychological state of being lustful? Dante's poetry is describing that human condition where we give in to strong passion without having our reason to guide us. We go nowhere in that circular sweep, but return to the same old clandestine or not so clandestine meetings with our lover to repeat the one act of surrender. But so long as we are abandoned to lust, not moving beyond that circle. In Latin, the word for lust is luxuria. We luxuriate in this passive state for the immediate thrills it gives us until we suddenly become aware that we've lost all control. And here is, I think, the perfect song to illustrate this state. It's a Hank Snow song called 90 Miles an Hour. But of course, since we have the choice, we'll hear the Dylan cover, which is, in my mind, one of Dylan's most powerful performances. Let's have the words first to introduce the flavor and then move over to the full performance. I took you home from a party and we kissed in fun. A few stolen kisses and no harm was done. Instead of stopping when we could, we went right on till suddenly we found that the brakes were gone. You belong to someone else, and I do too. It's just crazy being here with you. As a bad motorcycle with the devil in the seat, going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street. I didn't want to want you, but now I have no choice. It's too late to listen to that warning voice. All I hear is thunder of two hearts beat going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street. You're not free to belong to me, and you know I could never be your own. Your lips on mine are like a sweet, sweet wine, but we're heading for a wall of stone. Warning signs are a-flashing everywhere, but we pay no heed. Instead of slowing down the pace, we keep a-picking up speed. Disaster's getting closer every time we meet, going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street.
I took you home from a party and we kissed in fun. A few stolen kisses and no harm was done. Instead of stopping when we could, we went right on. Till suddenly we found that the brakes were gone. You belong being here with you. There's a bad motorcycle with the devil in the seat, doing 90 miles an hour down a dead end street. 90 miles an hour down a dead end street. I didn't want you, and now I have no choice. It's too late to listen to that warning voice. All I hear is thunder, two hearts beat, doing 90 miles an hour down a dead end street. Yeah, 90 miles an hour down a dead end street. You're not free to belong to me, and you know I could never be your own. Your lips on mine, I like sweet, sweet wine, but we're heading for a wall of stone. Warning signs are flashing everywhere, but we pay no heed. Instead of slowing down the pace, we keep picking up speed. Disaster's getting closer every time we meet, doing 90 miles an hour down a dead end street. Yeah, 90 miles an hour down a dead end street. Well, 90 miles an hour down a dead.
Did you like that? I think that's a wonderful song. But it sure is a slow song for someone speeding to ruin. As though the music has its brakes on, if not those two lovers. Or maybe, like, just before you have an accident, time seems to slow down. Maybe that's what it is. And who's that singing bass? Well, it's Bob Dylan's 90 Miles an Hour Down a Dead End Street. Coming to us here on Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson at Cambridge 105. The two lovers in the song, both already attached to someone else, give in to the passion that they at first innocently started playing with, a few stolen kisses and no harm was done. That luxuriating in those few stolen kisses was the moment of lust. It's the moment of lust, as Dante would say, the moment they surrendered to a passion they knew was wrong. And soon it became too late to listen to that warning voice, and instead of slowing down the pace, they kept up picking up speed. As a bad motorcycle with the devil in the seat, going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street, buffeted by that infernal storm, sweeping them into meaningless circles. So lust in Dante here is not quite the strong passion we usually associate with lust. In fact, lust is a weakness. It's a sin because it is a surrendering to something we know we shouldn't surrender to. And we can see that this poetic image can be extended beyond just the sexual sin. We can be lustful when we give in to our desire for chocolate, for instance, when we know it is no good for our diabetes. Or when we choose not to resist the urge to sit down at a gambling table, even when we know we cannot afford to lose any money. And of course there's the familiar line, well, okay, one more drink then before I drive home. It might seem pretty innocuous. You're just being polite to the host who's offering you another drink. But you know you're about to get into your car, don't you? The sin here is not driving while drunk, but in giving in to that last drink. This, in fact, happened to a friend of mine who was pressed just before he left a dinner party to have one more drink, and he was stopped by the police on the way home and lost his license for over a year. Well, at least it gave him plenty of time to repent, and it's unlikely he'll allow that bufera infernal, that infernal storm, to control him again. Well, all right, here's another little song that illustrates this dilemma. The Clovers, One Mint Julep. The story of a man who took a woman home, back to her parents' house, as we discover, thinking they'll finish up the evening with a few innocent nips, but all she had were mint juleps, and that, he says, was their downfall. I don't remember just how it started. I only know that we should have parted. He stole a kiss and then another. I didn't mean to take it further. Uh-oh, that's how these lustful things get started. Then all of a sudden her father showed up and forced him into a shotgun marriage, and here he is, with a wife and 6 kids, a situation he obviously doesn't like. This is his version of hell, buffeted about by the demands of family life.
Slaughter. I didn't know just what I was doing. I had to marry all face ruin. A mint julep, a mint julep, a mint julep, a mint julep. Oh, mint julep was the cause of it all. Now on I'll be thinking double. I'm through with flirting and drinking with
I got 6 extra children from a getting frisky.
Oh, a man and julep, a man julep, a man julep, a man julep. One man julep was the cause of it all.
The Clovers, One Mint Julep. Notice the way he blames the mint julep. One mint julep was the cause of it all. That's a real clue that he belongs here in the second circle of the Inferno. When we meet Francesca, we'll see that's just what she does. She blames everything and everyone except her own self. But before we meet Francesca, we're given a catalogue of various famous lussoriosi, souls inhabiting this region because they surrendered to passion when they shouldn't have. Dante and Virgil are standing there watching as flock after flock of these souls whirl by, impelled by that bufera infernal. Virgil identifies a few of them for Dante. First there comes Semiramis, a character from legend rather than actual history. She was the wife of Ninus, or Ninny, as Bottom keeps calling him in A Midsummer Night's Dream, king of Assyria, and after his death she became the ruler, celebrated for her military victories and for her work restoring the city of Babylon to its former greatness. In other words, she is regarded as a great and enlightened ruler, but here's the problem. She lusted after her own son, surely a passion against right reason, But such had become her loss of intelligent vision, she thought she could make sex with her own son legitimate simply by enacting a law that legalized incest. That's a bit like someone who's overweight altering the scientific findings to show that, in fact, excess fat on the body acts as a preventative to heart disease. Who are you fooling? You can change the wording all you want, but you can't change the truth. You succeed only in deluding yourself, losing the good of your intellect as you surrender to your pleasure. Well, next, Virgil points out Dido, the heroine of the fourth book of Virgil's Aeneid, who broke her promise to her dead husband to remain faithful when she gave in to her passion for Aeneas. And when he left her to obey his mission to found the city of Rome, she killed herself. Breaking faith because of passion is the sin of lust. But it's even worse when you're the head of a community and give in to your passion instead of doing the important job you've been given. As Robin Kirkpatrick puts it, here, as throughout, it is clear that for Dante there is no such thing as private sin. The consequences of sin are always likely to reverberate throughout the public body.
Thank you.
That was Dido's final aria in Purcell's opera Dido and Aeneas, with words by Nahum Tate with the Academy of Ancient Music. Dido, about to die, pleads, "Remember me, but ah, forget my fate." Well, Dante remembers her, but also remembers her fate as she whizzes past in that infernal storm. Next comes Cleopatra, Cleopatras Lusoriosa, who married her brother Ptolemy, that was the custom of the time, does that forgive the act, and then apparently fell in love with Julius Caesar, or at least had a child with him, and then with Mark Antony. Maybe this was where she really sinned, as Antony and Cleopatra luxuriated in their sensuous Eastern decadence, ignoring the demands of ruling Egypt and the whole Eastern part of the Roman Empire. Oh, and look, there's Helen of Troy, blamed here for causing the Trojan War because she ran off with the Trojan prince Paris and betrayed her husband Menelaus. But she doesn't get the whole blame. Paris is there in the crowd, too. And then comes Achilles, the greatest warrior among the Greeks at the Trojan War. Dante draws upon a tradition that Achilles ignored his duties to his Greek allies and entered Troy in order to marry Polyxena, a Trojan princess he had fallen in love with. But it was a trap, and here he was killed. He let his passion outweigh his reason, and here he is at the second circle. Virgil names più di mille ombre, more than 1,000 other souls, who whirled along past them. Great names from the past and from legend. And Dante picks out from that crowd a pair of souls moving along together. He seems to recognize them and wants to speak with them. "Oh, sure," says Virgil, "if you entreat them by the love that leads them, they will come." Why is that? Well, it seems to be a feature of lust that anyone can control these souls but themselves. They're so passive that they'll do anything for you as long as you harness the love that leads them, the love that they've surrendered their free will to. And so then here comes Paolo and Francesca in what is probably the most famous moment in Dante's Divine Comedy. They come to Dante from the same group of sinners as Dido was in, giving us a clue that their passion had something to do with betraying a marriage vow. Now, these are real historical characters, still alive in Rimini when Dante was a child. Francesca was an aristocrat who was married for political reasons to Gianciotto Malatesta. Gianciotto was physically deformed and perhaps also very mean-spirited, and he sent his handsome brother Paolo to negotiate the marriage contract with Francesca's family. According to one story, Francesca saw him and was overjoyed to think that this was going to be her husband. She found out differently when she arrived in Rimini for the wedding. In some stories, it took about 10 years of suffering under this harsh husband for Francesca to start her love affair with Paolo, who was also married, and there were children in both marriages. Then one day, Gianciotto caught the two of them in bed together and killed them both. Dante assumes that everyone knew this story, which was as recent in popular memory as, say, Bill Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky. And it's a poignant story. All our sympathies go to the deceived and abused wife. When she speaks to Dante, she shows herself to be graceful, elegant, and charming, and yet, let's see what she says. Her words are very complex, very nuanced, and I'm afraid we don't really have time to do them justice. But we'll do them partial justice if we can. "O animal grazioso e benigno," she begins, "O living creature, gracious and kind, who comes through the dark air to visit us, who stained the world with blood." This starts off very attractively, but what do we think about the two of them having stained the world with blood? Francesca just lets this pass, but we should keep it in mind. Their affair led to the violence with which it was destroyed. If the king of the universe were our friend, Francesca continues, implying that it's God who broke off the friendship. It's all God's fault. If he were their friend, we would pray that he might give you peace, since you show pity for our grievous plight. That's a nice offer, but entirely empty. It's like saying to a barefoot waif, if I had the money, I'd buy you some nice shoes. No, it's more like, if my daddy had given me any money this week, I would buy you some nice shoes. An empty gesture with a sting of blame elsewhere. Then comes a series of three statements, each beginning amor, love, in which Francesca casts the blame for what's happened to her on love. Love made this man fall in love with my beautiful form. And when someone loves you, love forces you to love that person back. And it was love that brought us to this one death together. Oh yes, and by the way, the man who killed us will find his place at the bottom of hell. Francesca is successful. Dante is touched and bows his head in pity. He then asks Francesca to fill in the details for him, like some journalist trying to squeeze some further juicy bits out of a celebrity story that's been all over the press. Tell me how you both first knew you loved each other, the confidential details. That's just me putting it into modern language. What Dante actually does is buy into Francesca's account and ask what happened when love acquainted you with your hesitant desires. Again, it's all love's doings, none of their own. And catch the double-edged graciousness of Francesca's answer. There is no greater sorrow, she says, than to recall our time of joy in wretchedness. It's true, of course, that remembering joyful times during times of great pain and sorrow is in itself very painful, but it's not the greatest sorrow. She's building up the self-pity here, in essence, telling Dante that what he asks for will be hard for her, but she'll do it for him because, well, because he's so nice. And here's the story she tells, which Dante the poet made up for the purpose of his story. One day, the two of them, for pleasure, were sitting reading the story of Lancelot's love for Guinevere. Not quite the sort of passionate romance a brother and sister-in-law should be luxuriating in. But Francesca hopes we'll not think of that, but rather melt in the tenderness at the recollection of that famous love affair. You remember it, don't you? Guinevere married to King Arthur, Lancelot's best friend. But Guinevere and Lancelot fall in love, and finally their illicit love destroys Arthur's whole glorious kingdom. More than once, Francesca says, that reading made our eyes meet and drained the color from our faces. But they kept on reading. As the song said, instead of stopping when we could, we went right on, till suddenly we found that the brakes were gone. And then, when they read the part where Lancelot finally kisses Guinevere, then tutto tremante, all trembling, Paolo kissed her on the mouth. Quel giorno più non vi leggemo avanti. That day we read no further. Here's one of the great romantic moments in literature, and people naturally disagree about where our sympathies lie or should lie. My sense is that our sympathies lie with Francesca until we exercise il ben dall'intelletto and look at this clearly. For one thing, Francesca has reversed the role of the lovers. In the French romance Lancelot du Lac, it is Guinevere who makes the first move and kisses the bashful Lancelot. Has Francesca then distorted her account in order to make it seem that it was Paolo who first kissed her, therefore absolving herself from starting it? Everything she says seems to be blaming someone else, never herself. She even blames the book they were reading and its author. Now here, if we needed it, is confirmation that she's lost the good of her intellect. She lives in a world of self-deception, or in a world where she needs so desperately to have Dante's sympathy, fat lot of good it will do her now, that she will tell her story in whatever way she thinks will most arouse pity. And Paolo? What's he been doing all this time? He says nothing, he just weeps. Though it's not clear whether he's weeping from his own painful suffering or from having brought from having bought Francesca's sorrowful account of how they ended up here through no fault of their own. But Dante seems to fall for her story, literally. For the second time in the Inferno, he faints, overwhelmed perhaps by pity, or by the conflict between what his reason tells him and the sentiment aroused by the seductive Francesca. I fell, he says, as a dead body falls. End of canto. And end of this week's show. Come back next time, in a fortnight, for our descent further into hell, to the circle of gluttony, not as exciting a sin, and a much more disgusting punishment. I suppose we'll also have to include lots of songs about food. And so it's time to say goodnight from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, thanking you for attending with us on this evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105. And we'll go out with a few minutes of Tchaikovsky's Francesca da Rimini, one of those romantic treatments of the Paolo and Francesca story.